today I'm speaking on the doctrine of God and the analogy of being. And as a philosophic matter, the doctrine of God is founded upon understanding of the analogia entis. After all, no other foundation is possible, as outside being, there is nothing. The analogicity of being and its foundational character are conspicuous. First, in his Metaphysics, Aristotle affirms that being is not a genus, as it must contain all its differences, whereas a genus cannot contain the difference that is the foundation of species, because then all beings of that genus would necessarily be of that species. Nor yet could being be a species as though it modified a substratum defined in terms of non-being. Thomas very clearly concurs with this teaching and develops it with great precision. As Thomas puts it, quote, "Nothing is able to be outside that which is understood by being if being is included in the understanding of the things of which it is predicated," end quote. Another way to understand the foundational relation of the analogical formality of being for the doctrine of God is the realization that there can be nothing in the conclusion of our reasoning that is not implicitly and actually present in the premises. Thus, if being means only being material in the premises that found our reasoning to the existence of God, then being can only mean being material in our conclusion. Hence, the analogical character of being is prior to and the foundation for the philosophic judgment that God exists, although some recognize the nature of this premise only after realizing the conclusion they have drawn. But the judgment that being is intrinsically analogous is not something solely available following the proof that God exists. My remarks today address, first, the foundation of the Aristotelian and Thomistic doctrine of God in the analogia entis, the analogy of being, understood in terms of the division of being by act and potency. Second, I consider the foundations of metaphysics and the real distinction of essence and existence. Third, this paper concludes by considering how this understanding provides the rational foundations for an account of God as infinite in every transcendental and pure perfection, and as transcendent cause of finite being. Thus, this lecture is a little like a victory lap around the presentations of earlier speakers with a few addenda of my own. The formality of being is an analogical formality. Aristotle articulates the roots of the analogy of being in the division of being by act and potency. In Book 9, Chapter 6 of the Metaphysics, quote, "Our meaning can be seen in the particular cases by induction, and we must not seek a definition of everything, but be content to grasp the analogy. That is, that which is building is to that which is capable of building, so is the waking to the sleeping, and that which is seeing to that which has its eyes shut but has sight, and that which is shaped out of the matter to the matter, and that which has been wrought to the unwrought. Let actuality be defined by one member of this antithesis and the potential by the other. But all things are not said in the same sense to exist actually, but only by analogy, as A is in B or to B, C is in D or to D, for some are as movement to potency and the others as substance to some sort of matter," end quote. At the beginning of chapter 9 of book 11, Aristotle further explains the metaphysical universality of the act-potency distinction and the metaphysical extension of the term motion. Quote, "Each kind of thing being divided into the potential and the fulfilled, I call the actuality of the potential as such, movement," end quote. St. Thomas, of course, alike holds that being is divided by act and potency, and that movement refers to the reduction of anything whatsoever from potency to act. This foundational division of being by act and potency is intelligible according to the analogy of proper proportionality. As potentially walking is to actually walking, so is potentially understanding to actually understanding. Although walking and understanding are simply different, a likeness of diverse proportions. Normally, we reduce likeness to one univocal aspect. For example, circularity, set of different circular things, where circular has but one ratio. But being is and can be, and is and can be thought and said in many ways, something that is discernible through simple rational induction. In Aristotle's account of physical beings, he achieves an analysis whose principles are actually and implicitly of metaphysical scope, but which are initially worked out in the explanation of being and change. What is not commonly realized is the metaphysical valence of Aristotle's analysis, the foundational character of the analogical division of being by potency and act, and indeed the understanding of motion as any reduction of a thing from potency to act, all of which, as noted above, are expressly shared by St. Thomas. The metaphysics of God derives from the objective evidence of proportionate being, and the analogicity of being comes to light in the division of being by act and potency, dividing being as such. In this light, two principles are paramount, as we've seen in earlier lectures: the application of the principle of non-contradiction to being, and the analogical division of being by act and potency. As for the principle of non-contradiction, Thomas himself is very clear in affirming that, quote, as sound is the first audible, being is the first intelligible, end quote. Thus, any denial that being is universally intelligible leaves precisely nothing intelligible, since outside of being, there is nothing. The very principle of non-contradiction, in its chief and metaphysical formulation, that being is not non-being, is, according to St. Thomas in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 94, article 2, the basis for the logical principle of non-contradiction. Thomas, in referring to the logical principle, adds, quote, quod fundator supra rationem entis et non entis, which is based on the nature of being and non-being. This is a universal principle pertaining to being as such, and if it were not, then fundamentally there could be no such thing as objectivity, because the mind would have no root capacity to conform to what is the case. The principle of non-contradiction articulates a real distinction, although not a real relation between being and non-being. It's not a real relation, because what does not exist cannot have real relations. But it is a real distinction, because by virtue of the character of being as such, it is contrary to non-being. Similarly, for example, even were there no creatures, it would be true that God is not a finite being, because by the very nature of God, he cannot be finite. Being is real, and hence really distinguished from its negation, which is not real. Precisely because of the ontological nature of the principle of non-contradiction, this principle raises the specter of monism as visible in the teaching of Parmenides and other forms of monism. Parmenides taught that being is one, immobile and unlimited, one because there is nothing other than being, and being is identical with itself, unchanging because being could not change into anything other than non-being, and non-being is not, and unlimited because nothing exists outside being that could actually limit it. Of course, one might look up into the air and see a flock of birds go by and note that they're real. There are many of them. Observe the change in their bodily positions and action, and note that they're all limited. So it would be easy to stop there with the rejection of monism as false. But Aristotle realized that an account must yet be given explaining how the principle of non-contradiction as pertaining to being may be reconciled with manyness, limit, and change. Otherwise, it would seem that sensible being is simply and radically unintelligible. It is one thing to realize that the Parmenidean account is incongruent with real evidence. It is another to understand how the real evidence is compatible with the principle of non-contradiction as an ontological principle, without which objective knowledge of the real would be impossible. Aristotle affirms a real principle in things accounting for the susceptibility of being, to manyness, limit, and change, a principle not identical with act, and yet not merely non-being, namely potentia, potency. We know that monism is incorrect if we trust our senses. We understand why monism is incorrect when we understand that potency is a real capacity founded upon act while not being itself actual. The marble is only potentially sculptable, but it is of its actual nature to be so. The principle of non-contradiction would necessitate denying manyness, limitation, and change only if potentiality did not pertain to real being. Hence, the principle of non-contradiction applies to real being even when limited by potency. Hence, being whose actuality is limited by its potential principle is limited in relation to that potency. Thus, all diverse analogical participations of being, all the various rationes or proportions of act as limited by potency, are what they are and not another thing. While Aristotle does not bring out the implications of this analysis in every respect, among other things, what is at stake is the metaphysical axiom manifest in St. Thomas's teaching, that act is not self-limiting. This axiom is in a way implied by the principle of non-contradiction itself, that being is not non-being. Likewise, St. Thomas's account of the participation of being by finite creatures is intelligible only in relation to the limitation of act by potency. As Kluvertanz notes in his work on analogy, after the scriptum on the sentences, Thomas always explains that the totality of any participated perfection is not possessed in its entirety by the participating subject because the participated perfection can be received only according to the limitation of potency in the participating being. St. Thomas situates a doctrine of the Platonic and Neoplatonic origins, the doctrine of participation, firmly within an Aristotelian analysis. The perception that being is and can be, and is and can be said in many ways according to the likeness of differing rationes or proportions of act as limited by potency, involves what John of St. Thomas will call a confusio, or fusing together of differing modes of being, each of which is what it is and not another thing, but each of which is by induction able to be grasped precisely as a certain measure of act in relation to potentia. So understood, being is not univocal, but transcends generic and specific unity. St. Thomas notes in Summa Theologiae Prima Pars, question 88, article 2, ad 4, that only the logical genus of substance, but no natural genus, unites separate substances or angels with material things. The angel with the butterfly. There is no natural genus of angel butterfly. Substance is not univocal, for it is and can be, and is and can be said and thought in many essentially varied ways, from the butterfly even to God. Yet there is an analogical likeness of diverse perfections of act. The angel and the butterfly and the existences of the angel and butterfly are simply different. Yet as existence is to the angel, so is existence to the butterfly. Being is not univocal like circularity, which signifies one thing, however disparate its instances, but is intrinsically analogical with the analogicity of proper proportionality. This does not reduce to the merely mathematical, such as 2 is to 4, as 3 is to 6, which reduces to one mathematical object, namely one half. For example, light is to the eye, as is truth to the mind. But light is not truth, the eye is not the mind, and the illumination in question is not univocal. This is a likeness of things that are different and that need not be generically or specifically identical. It must also be noted that in De Veritate, question 2, article 11, St. Thomas expressly identifies the analogy of being true and good with that of proper proportionality, a proposition which he nowhere retracts. While later on he uses the term proportion of creature to God exclusively in the sense of what in De Veritate he called an analogy of transferred proportion. Such transferred proportion is not a commensuration in a reciprocal determined relation, but does allow for a one-way proportioning of creature to God, and is not, strictly speaking, a proportion that could determine God in relation to the creature. The analogy of proper proportionality, as distinct from any analogy of strict proportion, does not require proper reciprocal determined relation to exist between the things analogically likened to one another. I mean, if I say that the dime is twice the nickel, then the nickel is half the dime. But the creature is really ordered to God, the converse is not the case. Thus, the analogy of being as an analogy of proper proportionality can extend to God, who is infinitely transcendent of the creature. The creature is really ordered to God, but not the converse. And the analogy of proper proportionality alone permits intrinsic attribution of God without implying any determinate real relation of God to the creature. In Thomas's later works, when he speaks of proportion between creature and God, he is very clear that this term means merely any relation of one thing to another, but that it must expressly negate real order of God to the creature. Creation itself is not even an accident with respect to God as actus purus, who is so perfect that creating or not creating designates no change in God, but only in the creature. In any case, it is upon the analogical formality of being as a likeness of diverse proportions of act, a non-univocal object, less subject to precision than the objects of the positive sciences, that the analyses of physical motion and change, of substance and accident, of the four causes of human nature in the human person, and of the derivation of all finite being from God, reposes. The distinction of potency and act is found in many ways. For example, substance is to accident as potency is to act. Matter is to form as potency is to act. Essence is to existence as potency to act, and so on. It is precisely as a further development of the division of being by act and potency that Thomas's doctrine of the real distinction of essence and existence is properly understood. The analogical divisibility of being into potency and act is thus also the foundation of the causal resolution of limited finite being into the unlimited infinite first cause of all creatures. Before turning to the doctrine of God straightforwardly, a few words must be spoken about the foundations of metaphysics and the real distinction of essence and existence. Much has been written about the foundation of metaphysics. Jan Ertsen, in his famous Medieval Philosophy and the Transcendentals, considers that Aquinas abandoned his teaching in De Veritate regarding analogy of proper proportionality. Nonetheless, I'm strongly sympathetic with aspects of his analysis. In the following long quotation, Ertsen writes, quote, "The distinctive feature of St. Thomas's transcendental way of thought is that it moves in two directions, toward the transcendentality of being and toward that which is common by causality. The first movement is a resolution by which things are reduced to what is most common in them. In this reduction, the specific determinations of things are left outside of consideration. They are considered not as this or that being, but as beings. Being as such does not signify dependence, nor does it imply any restriction. It is indeterminate with respect to every mode of being. Being is common to all genera and is therefore called transcendental. The first resolution moves on a horizontal plane. It is an intrinsic analysis of that which is. The formal principle whereby a thing is being, ends, is its act of being, esse. The inner resolution is the condition for another resolution. the assent to the most universal cause. Given the first resolution, it is clear that the most universal cause can only be the cause of being, for its causality is transcendental. The origin of being in general is understood as creation and explained in terms of participation. Being is the proper effect of God. He himself transcends being in general. God does not belong to the domain of the maxime communia. Thomas's transcendental way of thought seeks both the inner principle and the extrinsic cause by which a thing is being, end quote. Thus Erickson. Yet while God does not fall within ens commune, or the being affirmed of substance in the categories, nonetheless, being is affirmed of God in its full perfection, without potency. Proper proportionality permits genuine affirmation that God is pure act, infinite being, true, good, and so forth. Without proper proportionality, the affirmation of God would either reduce God to finitude, a real determined reciprocal proportion to finite things, or else involve no genuine cognitive content whatsoever. The resolution to God would be unintelligible. God does indeed transcend being in general, or ens commune, but nonetheless we do affirm that God is the full perfection of being, and this affirmation must be intelligible. Hence the analogical formality of being is necessarily that of proper proportionality. Analogy of proper proportionality does not imply reciprocal real proportion. Permitting the affirmation of infinite perfection in God, nonetheless, it is consistent with real proportion or determined relation where these actually can be found, where they obtain, namely amongst diverse finite analogical perfections in created being. Thus, as the angel is to its being, so is the butterfly to its simple diversity. While yet we can affirm that the angel is of a superior grade of actuality to the butterfly, we can see real analogical diversity and relations of determinate finite perfections. But it is not the real analogical character of their relation that requires this determinacy, but rather the finite limit of their perfection of act. By contrast, God is not merely first in a series, separated by the other from the others by a limited gradation of perfection. God is first as infinitely transcending the creature. Within finite being, there are gradations of being. Yet the analogical formality of being as such does not require determined real proportion, but only the likeness of differing proportions of act. Thus, wisdom in Solomon and wisdom in God are analogically diverse, and the wisdom of Solomon is a deficient but real likeness of the wisdom of God, while the wisdom of God has no real determinate relation to the wisdom of Solomon, but infinitely transcends it and is in no way limited by it. Thus, perfections, being true good, may be intrinsically predicated of God because no reciprocal proportion with the creature is required. Even the relation of creation in the creature is founded on Haben's essay, on the creature having existence, because creation is not even an accident in God, who undergoes no change or relation of dependency. As Thomas argues in his Scriptum on the Sentences, if creation signifies God, it can signify only the immutable divine substance. If it signifies the creature, it signifies having being from another, which as a real relation is founded upon the creature having being, since non-existent creatures do not have real relations. Thus, the real foundation of the relation of createdness and of causal participation, the difference between God creating and God not creating, is the analogical formality of being in the creature. God is infinitely transcendent of finite being. Erickson distinguishes the horizontal discovery of the being common to substance in the categories the resolutio secundum rationem, as it is called, and the vertical resolution of finite created being into the causality of God, the resolutio secundum rem, noting that the first is the condition for the second. And I sympathize strongly with this, but the rationem in Erickson's formulation must be taken not merely as reason, but as pertaining to real ontological measure. The reason for this is simply that one cannot achieve a real positive conclusion without real premises, and I think Erickson intends this. The analogical division of being by potency and act is the condition for the assent to the affirmation of God. It's often proposed that only after the demonstration of the existence of God is metaphysics possible as a science distinct from the physics. Thus, it is thought the subject matter of the metaphysics presupposes prior demonstrations in the physics. Yet Thomas doesn't say precisely this, nor does he identify the subject matter of metaphysics with God, but with ens commune, the being common to substance and the predicables of which God is the first principle and cause. Thus, God is rationally inferred as the principle of the subject matter of ens commune in a causal resolution from limited being which cannot account for itself to actus purus. It is true that Thomas says in the Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 1, Chapter 12, that, quote, if there is no knowable substance higher than a sensible substance, there will be no science higher than physics, end quote. Arguably, if the existence of God were unknowable, metaphysics would not be possible. This is something quite intelligible, since Thomas holds there to be metaphysical demonstrations of God. So, if P implies Q, then not Q means not P. Thomas holds there to be metaphysical demonstrations of God. If that's essential to metaphysics and there is no God, then there is no metaphysics. As we have seen above, we may discover that the subject matter of metaphysics is distinct from the subject matter of the physics, which is the quasi-genus of material changing and moving being, in discovering that material being as a genus is incapable of coextensivity with being. This is because a genus does not include its differentiae, its differences, whereas being necessarily includes all its inferiors, since otherwise they will be held not to exist. Discovery of the reason why this is true, however, requires the later metaphysical realization that existence overpasses the entire order of material quiddity, that a thing is a real being not because of its mode of being, but because it actually exists. The judgment of separatio is the negative judgment that the intelligibility of being as such is irreducible to the quasi-genus of material being, the realm of matter and motion, which is clear from the fact that being transcends all genera. It is also clear from the truth that being overpasses material essence by reason of esse, and that potency and matter exist owing to esse, existence, and not the converse, just as potency always exists for the sake of act, and not the converse. The irreducibility of being to material being is, in truth, implicit in the principle of non-contradiction itself. Being is not its own negation. Act qua act is not self-limited, but limited only by potentia. This, of course, does not suffice to prove that God exists, but only to indicate that our initial knowledge of being cannot rule out the possibility of immaterial things, which would be the case if being from the start meant merely material being, right? If it's the case that from the start being means only material being, then you can't have something in your conclusion that isn't in the premises, right? So your conclusion will be to a material being. If and only if the premises are intrinsically analogous is it possible to demonstrate God, period, end of sentence. Yet one is in no position to derive metaphysical judgments except from proportionate being. And this for human creatures largely but not exclusively designates the world of changing, moving things. It's no accident that the metaphysical principles necessary to respond to Parmenides are also the principles necessary for the analysis of mobile being. The principles discovered in the physics are implicitly and actually of metaphysical import from the start. Form, matter, agent cause, final cause, substance, accident, and of course act and potency. The difference is whether these principles are derived solely for the sake of analyzing physical motion and change, or whether they are derived to analyze being and motion as such. Remembering that motion is an analogical term that Thomas, with Aristotle, holds to pertain to the actualization of potency as such universally. While metaphysics is not merely Aristotelian physics on steroids, nonetheless, the philosophy of nature is in the order of learning and of analytic resolution prior to the metaphysics. Yet it does not give metaphysics its subject, which is presupposed to the physics, because the object of the physics exists. When one becomes aware of the intrinsic analogicity of being demarcates the discovery of the subject matter of metaphysics, but much more is needed to pursue this subject matter than its mere recognition. Working through the proportionate applicability of metaphysical principles is heuristically necessary. Nonetheless, physical beings are beings not because they are physical, but because they are. And being is not a genus, not even the quasi-genus of physical motion and change. Act is not act because it is joined to potency. Being is intrinsically analogical, consisting in a likeness of diverse proportions of actuality. This is the created corollary of the truth that the divine essence is imitable in many ways. It ought also be observed that Thomas expressly affirms that metaphysics gives the principles to all the other sciences. They all presuppose being, and receives reciprocally from them only the particular limitations and causal implications derivative from their particular objects, all of which presuppose being. It's very clear that Thomas does not think that metaphysics is formally dependent on the physics, but the other way around, because being is presupposed to physical being. If the limitation common to physical being were taken as most formal, which is already a contradiction in terms, then either physical being would be nothing but potency, or else it would be actus purus, both of which are absurd. As for the real distinction of essence and existence, it is a further development of Aristotle's distinction of act and potency. Thomas's account of esse as the form of forms is not expressly found in Aristotle, although I cannot concur with the argument made by the late Father Norris Clark that the metaphysical doctrine of the limitation of act by potency is not actually implicit in Aristotle's teaching. In my view, Aristotle clearly understands that manyness pertains to being only owing to potentia, and that there can be but one actus purus, whereas manyness involves act as limited by potency. Despite the influence of Avicenna, I do not consider the arguments of De Ente et Essentia given by Thomas to be merely Avicennian, nor does he anywhere renounce them. Finite quiddity or essence is intelligible to us, as Thomas teaches in the Summa Theologiae Prima Pars, question 85, articles 6 and 7. Regarding a proper object, a power is not subject to error, but only with respect to the relations of this object with other things. And the proper object of the human intellect is quiddity in corporeal matter. Thus the mind, in knowing essence, without in that same act of knowing, formally cognizing existence, realizes that the essences of real things are distinct from their existence, that the mode of their unity derives from the mode of their existence. Thomas must then universalize this real distinction of essence and existence discovered in physical things to include separate substances or angels. He argues that if there were even hypothetically a being whose essence were identical with its actual existence, there could only be one, because all the ways in which manyness accrue to being presuppose potentia, and by hypothesis such a being would lack all potency whatsoever. Thus, if there were a being comprising the full perfection of act, whose essence were its existence, there could be only one. A fortiori, then, even angels, of which we have no direct quidditative knowledge, must be such that they are composed of form and being, of essence and existence. Thus, since all finite beings, including the angels, of which we have no quidditative knowledge, are composites of potency and act, of essence and existence, all such beings must receive their existence ad extra, from outside. Esse is received as most formal. And because an infinite regress in essentially subordinated causes is impossible, and because even a potential infinitude of beings, which of themselves do not exist, must receive their being from without, they can receive it only from the one who is his own being, from God. We move from the analogical formality of being in the creature to the causal analysis, attributing the limited perfection of act as an effect to God, who is his own being. As Thomas explains the matter in De Ente, quote, "Everything that pertains to a thing is either caused by the principles of its nature, as risibility in man, or comes to it from an extrinsic principle, as light in the air, from the influence of the sun. Now it cannot be that being itself is caused by the form or quiddity of a thing, I mean as by an efficient cause, because that thing would then be its own cause, and it would bring itself into being, which is impossible. Therefore, it follows that everything whose being is other than its nature has its being from another. And because everything that exists through another is reduced to that which exists through itself as to its first cause, there must be something that is the cause of being for all other things, inasmuch as it is pure being. Otherwise, we would go on to infinity in causes, for everything that is not pure being has a cause of its being, as has been said. It is evident, then, that an intelligence, speaking of the angel, is form and being, and that it holds its being from the first being, which is pure being. And this is the first cause, or God," end quote. Regarding God as pure act, ipsum esse, as Thomas puts it in the Summa Theologiae, Prima Pars, question 28, article 2, ad 1, we find, quote, "Nothing that exists in God can have any relation to that wherein it exists, or of whom it is spoken, except the relation of identity, and this by reason of, propter, God's supreme simplicity," end quote. The very conditions under which we attain to the judgment that God is indicate that God is actus purus. This means, as Thomas puts it, that all perfections are affirmed of God as incomprehending God, because God is infinite, and as exceeded by God, because God, in God, the full perfection of all the transcendentals are found. But these are not synonyms. Justice and love are not different names for the same thing. The full perfection of all transcendental and pure perfections is found in God without limit, as incomprehending these perfections and exceeding them. That is, this is an affirmation of these perfections in a way that we don't know directly. Infinite perfection. No determined relation to the creature. Only proper proportionality permits this. Thus, there is no change, no potency, no real dependence or reciprocal relation to creatures in God. The divine essence is so perfect that creation signifies no change in God, but only his immutably perfect reality. In the creature, however, creation signifies having being from another, which, as we've seen, absolutely presupposes habens esse, having being. Thus, the relation of causal participation and of createdness is founded on the analogical formality of being in the creature and on the likeness of diverse actualities in creatures, existentially, substantially, formally, operatively, in accidents and relations. The analogy of being is an analogy of proper proportionality of diverse likenesses of act and potency, which permits determinate proportion among creatures where it may be found, but does not require such determinate proportion, permits intrinsic predication of God without implying real determined relation or reciprocal proportion of the Creator to the creature, or any dependence in God. St. Thomas Aquinas did very well in taking up and perfecting Aristotelian science for the sake of Sacra Doctrina, to augment our acquired contemplation of our provident Creator and Lord, the one who is. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. That was really amazing. So I'm interested in potency and its relation to act, because I'm just thinking, where does potency come from? I guess there's something that is receiving being, right? And I'm just trying to wrap my head around where that sort of is coming from. In Aristotle's worldview, it seems that he's more or less dualistic, because he has a principle of act and he has this principle of potency. And at a certain level in his metaphysics, I look at it and I go, it looks like the two really meet. And I know that Norris Clark did have a discussion in his work, Person and Being, about receptivity as a perfection. I just wondered maybe if you could touch on that topic in light of what you've said here.
Sure. Well, it's important not to think of this, of course, as non-existent potentia bopping about waiting. I mean, there is the objective possibility that God create, which is different from a subjective potency. Kevin White, a Catholic U, somewhere, I think it's in the Thomist, but it might be Review of Metaphysics, has an article where he talks about the divine intention terminating in esse, but God intends a being of a certain kind to exist, and so God causes the being with those determined limitations in the thing that exists. We can see that it is the actuality and not the limit that accounts for the being. But we're not thinking of as though they're non-existent. It's not like the Mormon, account of souls bopping about waiting to be born, as it were. There's only objective possibility that God create. God intends to create a being of a certain kind. That means an intrinsic limitation, capable of this but not of that. Long can confound people in the postprandial hour by his verbosity, but he cannot run like with the mellifluity of the panther, for example, right? So, with Clark, I think Father Clark had trouble with divine simplicity as well, right? I mean, I think that there is too great a tendency to read Aristotle in an insufficiently speculative manner. In other words, I don't think it's a stretch to read Thomas as Aristotle does, or as Thomas does. Did I say Aristotle? I'm getting them confused now. I'm proving the Thomas's Aristotle thesis linguistic. No, but I don't think it's a stretch for Thomas to have read Aristotle as he did. That, at least I think one can say that the principles are open to this development. That, for example, when Aristotle thinks of the unlimited as material and potentia, and as it were, disorder, entropy, as it were, that doesn't keep him from affirming that God is pure act. There, and the limit. This, there's also the sense in Aristotle in which potency limits. That is, you know, the form is reciprocally limited by in relation to matter, for example. That's in Aristotle. So I think there's tends to be an insufficiently philosophic reading of Aristotle.
So I was wondering about the relation of natural philosophy to metaphysics in two areas, I guess. So first, I know it's kind of a perennial debate that pops up, you know, is natural philosophy necessary before you do metaphysics? And you were saying, well, it seems to be in some ways, but the way that you're expressing metaphysics' priority to natural philosophy in terms of being was interesting to me. So is it that we can't begin thinking metaphysically until we've moved beyond our physical, our understanding of being in this physical sense, and therefore we have to prove something beyond physical being, which is, I guess, you know, the River Forest Lavallian take. And if not, how are you seeing the relationship between the understanding of being in the analogical sense, as opposed to what I think you would say is not quite as richly analogical?
Yeah, let me try. I think that, first of all, it's a perfectly reasonable thing that we often only discover what was implicitly and actually in our premises when we see what we draw from them. So in other words, I don't think it's incorrect to say that one may discover the subject matter of metaphysics by realizing what is actually flowing from one's premises. But I do think that the nature of those premises can be understood to exceed any univocal determination from the start, and that they are open. In other words, I don't think it can be the case that the understanding of being is simply coextensive with material being. If that's our premise, we're not going to be able to have something in our conclusion that, you know, it would be like saying Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, therefore Socrates is an angel. You can't get in your conclusion what isn't in the premises. And I do think it's possible to know the analogicity of being earlier. But that doesn't mean you're equipped to pursue it properly. To pursue it, if what you mean by the founding of the discipline is being equipped to pursue it, well, then you're going to need to have done the physics. I mean, because you have these principles are worked out in proportionate being. Right? So in the order of resolution, the physics is first. In the order of learning, the physics is first. But the physics has its subject matter from the metaphysics, that is, being, right? And one may comparatively early realize that this is a distinct subject matter, but that that doesn't give one automatically all the means necessary to pursue it, which have to be developed. Is that of any use?
As a follow-up, so you're saying that one doesn't necessarily have to prove an immaterial substance or an immaterial entity in order to be able to be equipped to start going off into metaphysics. It could happen earlier.
Yeah, well, I mean, one could be aware of the reality of the subject matter without, it seems to me, proving the existence of God, the immateriality of the soul, or so on. But to pursue it properly and adequately is going to require the working out of principles in the proportionate sphere. And I think people mischaracterize the judgment of separatio. I mean, in De Trinitate, Thomas says, well, in the same way that animality can be rational but need not, a being can but need not be material. And our native tendency will be to say, well, how could you know that if you didn't know there was something immaterial? But really what is required is simply to realize that material being isn't being because it's material. It's material because of its actuality, and actuality is not contained within a genus or species. So all you're getting, you're getting the openness of being to inquiry. You're getting being understood as not foreclosing the subject matter of whether immaterial things are or are not from the start. Because what being means is material being. If that is what it means, we're done. Mm-hmm. We're finished. We are never, right? I mean, so it can't, and it isn't that. It's not, being is not a genus. And being is intrinsically analogical, and the reason for this that we obscurely grasp in this judgment of separatio is that act overpasses potency. We don't know how, we don't know why, we don't know that a material being exists, we haven't proven God yet. Now, it's also true, though, that I think one can discover the subject matter of metaphysics by proving the existence of God. Because, excuse me, we often realize what's in our premises only when we see what we've drawn from them.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Locke. Said earlier something to the effect of act is limited by potency is implicit in Aristotle. Do you mean to imply that you think the real distinction is implicit in Aristotle?
I mean, in his account, I think it follows from his account. If you're asking me what was in the psyche of Aristotle, you know, do I think he actually held that? I mean, I don't think he held it with the kind of formality with which Thomas holds it. But on the other hand, I don't think that the sort of Gilsonian take on this is adequate either. That is, I don't think that he thinks of form as rendering questions of existence not real. You see, but the places where I would point to that are the logical works, and that's open to the criticism that it's precisely not the metaphysics. I would say it's actually implicit in his teaching. You know, bear in mind, right, very bright people hold things that they don't... think of Einstein. Einstein actually had exactly the same reasoning that proved his relativity theorem. He had written it 2 years before. It was on the back of an envelope. He looked at it and he thought, this can't be, and put it aside. So, I mean, I don't think there's any scandal in the fact that a mind as profound as Aristotle has premises that suggest this, that from which it seems to flow, but didn't draw the formal inference.
Thanks, Steve. I was wondering if you could say more about how you understand the passage in the De Ente et Essentia about the real distinction. Maybe little Ed Fazer handled this yesterday to everyone's satisfaction. But the way you described it sounded to me like it's this sort of form of argument that says, well, look, I can understand the essence of something, say human, or the other example he uses is Phoenix, without understanding that it exists or existence. Therefore, there must be a distinction between the essence and the existence. But it seems like in the passage there's a kind of scope ambiguity, right? There's the scope ambiguity, there's the sense of, well, look, I can understand essence of something without understanding its existence, right? Or I can understand the essence does not include existence. So in the first sense, my worry is that we say, okay, just consider some essence. Now think about that essence. We presuppose we have perfect knowledge of it. And we say when we understand that thing, we don't understand existence to be part of it. Therefore, there's a distinction. That looks a little too a priori for me.
Yeah, yeah. Let me, excellent. That's a fantastic question.
So the other way of thinking of it is that is, I understand the essence not to include existence is something for which one could give an argument and read what's going on there as giving an argument, and this may sound very odd, but actually an argument from natural philosophy for the distinction between essence and existence. And that's because the two examples Thomas gives are things in his view, particularly the phoenix is the problematic one. Natural beings that cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Human mm-hmm. beings cease to exist.
Yeah.
Now that's evidence for thinking
yeah.
existence is not part of the essence of the human. And since he probably didn't think a phoenix was a mythological character, it was a very odd material being, one single instance rather than many humans, but nonetheless subject to generation and corruption, he could say of its essence, given that it's subject to generation and corruption, its essence does not include existence. And then that still leaves up, so you have the distinction there,
mm-hmm.
by a positive exclusion of existence from the essence rather than a failure to understand existence
yeah.
as part
yeah.
of the essence.
Yeah.
Leaving open the possibility that there would be some essence where, in fact, that's not the case because of the identity.
Yeah. Let me respond. I mean, my route into this is, in a way, the proportionate object of the human intellect. In other words, when Thomas says the proper object of the human intellect is distinct from the adequate or the formal objects, the proper object is quiddity in corporeal matter. He has some criteria for what that means. That's not a and those. In other words, this is something that is per se known. So when in De Ente he says that no essence can be known without its parts, I don't think he means the definitive attributes of the essence, because he doesn't think often, in fact, most frequently, that we even get the proper difference of material things. It's not a question of knowing all of the attributes of essence so perfectly that now we can, but rather it's that we know the formal, no essence can be known without understanding its parts. I think what he means is, implicitly and actually, there has to be a grasp of form and matter as the generic parts of quiddity and corporeal matter. And when we know these, we do not know esse. That is to say, in the very act wherein we cognize the form of a sensible thing or its matter, we do not know esse. And in fact, you can take up all kinds of questions. Ed did some of this yesterday. You could say, well, but since we don't know all of the attributes of essence, we don't even know the proper differentiate, then why couldn't existence be an occult or a hidden attribute? And then you run into two problems. One is the Parmenidean problem, that you'd be saying the essence is self-existing. But the other is that formally you'd be saying all the other attributes don't exist. There are, in other words, if esse is a note, an essential attribute, right? Rational is not esse. Animal is not esse, right? There are problems of this kind. And I'm not sure, though, that my opting for the one side of the fork means that the other side is an invalid way to proceed. In other words, I think very well you can proceed with arguments in philosophy of nature. In a way, I think my own tendency is to think he's made the real distinction of essence and existence long before he gets to that consideration of the intellectus essentiae argument, which is why it's so brief, right? I think he's made it earlier. Now, this could rekindle our discussion from earlier today, right? But when he says that essence is in two different ways, one in intellectual consideration, where it has the accidents of genus and species, the other in the thing, where it has all of the predicables, right? And because this is the same quiddity, but existing in two distinct ways, we judge that existence and essence are really distinct. Then he gets to the next, and the subject of the next consideration is separate substances, right? So his the intellectus essentiae is a kind of dust off. It's very brief. And I'm also inclined to say that the order that he gives in this very telegraphic argument is significant, going from man to phoenix, because principally, we derive the knowledge of essence as a real principle in things. There's a way in which the phoenix the essence of the phoenix is not a real essence, right? But because he knows where this argument is going, there has to be a way to consider the truth that God could either have not created at all or have created differently. You know, as I say this, my wife will say, honey, couldn't you have been just slightly more thoughtful? I say, well, that would be a different universe, dear. You know? And we have to have a way to consider, right, that God could have created. Now, and this is gets us into trouble of possible worlds, about which I think we're right to be very skeptical and limiting.
Just a word on behalf of the phoenix, as unicorns and so on this morning. If it's the case, which is, it probably is the case, if it's the case that Thomas thinks that there is a phoenix, there's only one, it's like an angel, except that it's a material being which exhausts the species. It's a very interesting example in that setting, precisely because he has another option for a different sort of material being that does not provide evidence for the real distinction, namely superlunary beings, right? Mm-hmm. Which are material beings, but they're not subject to generation and corruption, so they don't provide you with evidence for the thought that their existence is distinct from their essence. But the phoenix may, in Thomas's thought, actually have a real essence, right?
Yeah.
But it's different from the human essence because it exhausts the species. In that sense, it's like an angel. But he doesn't appeal to notions of angelic essence.
It's like celestial matter in a way.
It's like sublunary matter, yeah. But it's like an angelic being.
Yeah, yeah. In that chapter, he has to present an answer to why it is that separate substances shouldn't be viewed as so many gods. Why not? I mean, they have no matter. How do you know they have potency? And when he says, well, this is where you see the implicitly and actually metaphysical valency of these principles, all the ways in which plurification, multiplicity, can accrue to being presupposed potentia. But ex hypothesi, if there is a being that is pure act, whose essence embraces the full perfection of esse, of existence, well, there could only be one, right? There could only be one. Therefore, a fortiori, in every other case, essence and existence are distinct. And then he goes on to give this argument for the existence of God, predicated on the universality of the real distinction. But look what he's had to do, and look how complicated it is. You've got to go through logic in relation, the metaphysician has to look at logical intentions in relation to being, and that's presupposed to even getting to the point of considering. This is not, however fundamental it is, I think it is in some ways the most fundamental argument. Other arguments that in a certain way co-imply it or arguably are derivative from it are more readily intelligible. I mean, certainly, you know, in the five ways, right? I mean, it seems that things move. That's a little bit easier to communicate.
I'm going to ask you a question and then give a little explanation for what motivates it. I appreciated your comments about Erickson and the inference, first of all, of the horizontal sort of compositional level being foundational for then the vertical causation, proper proportionality level of inference. Do you think that's just a matter of the order of discovery or of the order of reality? Where this is coming from is, it reminds me of the heart of the debate between Favreau and Geiger. Favreau seems to really prioritize the compositional horizontal level of participation and be very critical of Geiger, who prioritizes the vertical participation by similitude, vertical participation side of things. Maybe this isn't exactly the same issue, but it sounded similar to me, and I hadn't heard of Erickson's take on it. So if you have any opinion on this, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I would tend to prioritize the horizontal for this reason, that I think it's the foundation of the account of participation and the gradations, the hierarchy of perfection. In other words, one of the things that has made people wary of proper proportionality is that they think because it doesn't require determinate reciprocal proportion, that therefore it's incompatible with it where it may be found. But that's simply not the case. So there is a transgeneric, transpecific, a transcendental being participated by all creatures and participated according to different rationes. And these actually, as finite and determinate analogical perfections, can be compared with one another. It's an analogical comparison because it's transgeneric. We can say, look, the angel is a loftier mode of being than the tree. Its operations are simultaneously more interior and more universal, and represent a greater perfection of act. But no matter how great the perfection, the loftiest member in the series as a whole, are infinitely removed from God's. And this is why even that level of graded perfection with the finite determinate comparisons has to be, is folded into the analogy of proper proportionality. It's folded into it. We can see the determinate comparisons where they are, transgeneric, transspecific, but it isn't the analogy of being that requires that. It is the limitation of the things and their perfection and their comparison, right? It's their limitation, their determinate, limited actuality. So, and yet this enables us to make the ascent to God in a way that preserves the divine transcendence and that enables us to affirm an intelligible content, as it were, intelligible objects as being in a mode that we confess we do not know. That's a stab at it. It's a very, that's a very profound question.
So if it hasn't become clear yet over the course of the conference, I'm coming to this as an Aristotelian. And as an Aristotelian, I thought I'd figured out something about the relationship between act, form, essence, what it is. That is, some sort of relationship of identity. And I'm beginning to see just how complicated this is in Thomas. And every time I think I'm beginning to get a better grasp of it, something new and confusing pops up. And now, what you just said about act being limited by potentiality is adding a new level of confusion. So what I'm confused about...
Thank you. I've achieved something. I mean...
So what I'm confused about now is you said that act as being could not include not being in it, and therefore it needs potentiality in order to limit it. But it would seem that Aristotle, at least, wants to include potentiality within the act itself, insofar as undesignated matter is going to form part of the act, insofar as it forms part of the essence. So in...
Well, yeah, potency is a real principle. It's in the real being, right? But the real being is a composite of act and potency. And the proposition is that it is in the real being itself that we see the limitation of actuality by the potential principle. It's not somewhere else. I mean, potency is a real principle of being. It's a subjective capacity, if you like, right? Go ahead.
But insofar as the act is going to be the act of a particular being, and moreover the act that's determined by certain matter, insofar as the act that is a particular human being is going to be the act of an animal that is rational, with the animal functioning as matter, as Aristotle is going to say in Book 8 of the Metaphysics, that would seem that the act itself is already going to be including the potentiality, rather than the potentiality being something...
Well, see, I mean, the difficulty is here. We can talk about being in two ways. We can talk about being as that which is. And there you have, I mean, you have ends taken under the formality of essay there. Or we can talk about being as simply essay. We can talk about it in terms of what's called the actus essendi, the act of being. So what's confusing me is that the formulation is this, that that which is a composite of potency and act, but what is most formal in that composite is act. In other words, it isn't that the act is because of the potency, it is the other way about, right? And act is not self-limiting, act is limited in relation to potentia. But a non-existent, this is within the real being, this isn't something floating around, in the, right, as a, simply a possible. This is within the real being.
So one last short follow-up question. When you say in relation to potentiality, is that relation internal to the act, or is that a relation to something external?
Essay is uncomposed, Thomas will teach, right? It is uncomposed. Essay is simple. So it's outside the act, yeah. The act is that whereby. Now, it's not outside being, right? Being as a, as that which is. It's, potentia isn't outside being in that sense. But it is outside of being in the sense of the actus essendi.
If I may further specify this question, I mean, maybe to just ask you to give some more concrete examples, because I think this would be helpful to really get our hands on what Aquinas is saying. So, because it's an interesting question. If you have, if essay is an act, and it's limited or received by potency, where does the potency come from if the potency is not a being already? So I think that's a, it's kind of at the root of the...
Well, that, that's what... That's,
so, yeah, you know. So what I'm asking is, talk first maybe about angels, where we don't have the issue of matter. I mean, wouldn't it be the case that the angelic form, the essence, is the act of being of that essence is limited because of what it is?
Yeah, by this, by the angelic form. Yes.
So it's not as if there was something existing out there that then is given an act of existence. It's that the what it is determines or limits how it is, or the degree to which it is. It's actually, it limits the actuality, which of itself would not be limited.
Yes, I mean, it's not as though the actuality is to be conceived as a kind of univocal ocean being sort of poured into glasses, so to say, right? But it's that in God intends, I mean, you take it from the theistic vantage, God ordains some, a thing of a certain kind to be. A thing of that kind is limited by its essential nature. The jaguar is not an angel. The angel is not a frog, and so on, right? The essay, the act of being, is that whereby this kind of an entity is. And it's within the actual being, that which is, that we see the reciprocal relation, that we see the limitation of the act of being in relation to the nature, right? So, I mean, this is why it seems to me when Thomas Indiente mentions in that parenthetic, first man, then Phoenix, I think he has in mind, we go to a proximate sensible quiddity that is real, that we know. And then we go to something, now I know some people are saying that he thought that there could actually be a phoenix. I confess I'm somewhat skeptical about this. I mean, I tend to see it in the terms I spoke as reflecting his thought that we have to have some way to think about how we would speak of God's active power to bring forth natures, even which he has not brought forth. So it's within the real structure of things that we discover this distinction. I mean, again, I think in De Ente, insensible things the distinction is made early, and all and even the argument, the intellectus essentiae argument, is in the context of arguing about separate substances.
So just to raise another question that came up in discussion yesterday that I had with a number of other people. So I'm voicing the question. On day one, Father Brandt challenged us, he laid out the categories, and he challenged us to think of something that doesn't fall into one of the 10 categories. And then we're talking about esse, or the act of existence. That doesn't seem to fall into any of the categories. But we want to say that it's real, that it is.
Yeah.
Okay, comment.
Well, this is a transcendental perfection. It is not contained in a genus. It's not limited to a genus or a species. And I tend to think of the categories not merely logically but ontologically, but they seem to pertain to sensible quiddity, right?
So,
sensible quiddity. But we're presupposing there.
What is an act of being? Does it have an essence? Is it a hoc aliquid? Is it a res?
It's not a res. No.
Yeah, okay. So
no.
Could you just tease that out a little bit?
I'm very sympathetic with what Ed said the other day, that the only way to tease this out is through the route whereby you discover it, so that it is uncomposed. It is most formal in that outside of being, there is nothing, right? So outside of being, there isn't anything. It's uncomposed, it's simple, it's most formal. It isn't a subject, it isn't a thing, right? One can say all these things of it, but one isn't going to give an account of this the way I can explain what I'm going to forget that great Italian dish I had now. What is it? Bucatini or something? Ameritriciana or something? What is it? He's not. Help me, John. Amatriciana. Yeah. It's not as though I can describe esse the way I can describe the Ameritriciana at the cafe, which is just, if you've never had this, it's worth the trip to Rome just to go and eat it.
One quick follow-up on that. You said it's not a race, but wouldn't it have to be a race in a transcendental sense, since you described it as a transcendental being? So I'd assume it'd be a race in some way, analogically, a unum in some way, analogically.
I mean, Thomas will say it has co-esse, which is a strange way to speak, seems to me.
So the question is just, does it fall under the transcendentals, one of which is race?
Well, it's, I mean, I w- if you fall under, I would say...
The transcendentals are coextensive with being.
Yeah.
It sounds like this is a being or a perfection.
They fold, I mean, being as ens commune, if you take ens commune to be ens under the formality of esse, right, then... Then these transcendentals, insofar as you're talking about ens commune, will fold into being as most formally being by reason of esse. All right? I mean, what is most formal in being is esse, right? Unreceived, simple. So in that way, thing, one, good, true, fold into it.
Yeah, so just along the same lines, I think it would help if we go back to the thing that you were trying to emphasize, which is act and potency. So instead of just saying, well, I don't know what esse is, let's just go through the argument over and over until it dawns on us. Remember? Because that was the first thing Ed said, which was a good thing to say.
Yeah.
The second thing he said was act and potency, right?
Yeah.
So we start with... So act, potency, and ends, right? A being. So we start with a being, like a horse.
Yeah, the subject.
And then you can distinguish within it principles. Now, those principles are principles of beings, of this being. So they are not themselves beings, because then you have an infinite regress. So they aren't beings. They aren't race or any of those things. And
but beings fold into them, right? In other words, when you analyze the subject...
like the horse.
Yeah, it resolves into...
an actuality principle and a potentiality principle.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you think of it like this, but you always keep trying to start with the horse or whatever, then you don't have these worries like, you know, if you think of essays like this thing and then you add a potency to it, then you wonder, how does the potency get there before the act?
See, this is exactly, yes. See, this is why I think you can only make this intelligible in terms of the route whereby you reach its judgment, and that route is through the division of being by act and potency, and the consideration of essence in relation to existence. That there is no, it's in that way, and then we have these principles, and there are sort of, you know, there are places where you might wish you could push further. And it's,
right.
and perhaps there's some way of doing it, but I don't
see
it.
Yeah, well, they're correlative principles, too, right?
Yeah.
That's why you have to discover them in distinguishing them. I think we have time for just one more question.
Oh, Brother Isaiah, you want to ask the final?
Sure.
Make it a good one.
I'll try.
So it seems... from your presentation, especially your examples of the angel and the frog, etc., that you would see there to be not a univocal relationship of esse between even things within the genus of substance. And I've seen, for instance, Armand Maurer seems to take their... esse seems to almost never be univocal. For Dewan, it seems to be univocal within a type of matter. Would you say, is essay ever univocal? And if so, in what, between what beings is it a univocal?
Well, you can speak in a way of essay as univocal within a species, but if you go to the individual, there is a sense in which you can say, it seems to me on this Fabro is correct, that there is a respect in which even intraspecifically, since one blade of grass is not another blade of grass, that even within the species... there is analogicity. But yet you can, in a certain way, speak of esse as univocal to the species qua species, right? It's only insofar as the individual blade of grass in some way exceeds the species that, right, that we're saying there's analogicity. And by the way, you know, one has to bear in mind the difference between logical and natural genus. So, I mean, the angel and all material things share the logical genus of substance, but no natural genus because there's no common matter, right? This is one of these places where, again, many people think these arguments are invalid. For example, that things that are in a genus necessarily are subject to the real distinction. I don't think they're invalid. I think Thomas has looked at logical categories from the vantage point of the metaphysician and drawn judgments and given the reasons for drawing them, and then continues to do it, right? And they're not simple logical inferences. They presuppose the vantage point of the metaphysician looking at the logic and explaining this from the vantage point of being qua being, which is not something the logician qua logician necessarily knows.
Make our gratitude accurate.